Here's a fact that might reshape everything you thought you knew about global poverty. The world's poorest people collectively own assets worth over $9.3 trillion, twice the entire U.S. money supply, nearly equal to the value of all companies listed on the world's top 20 stock exchanges. Yet, they remain poor. How is this possible? The answer lies in what happens when wealth exists but cannot be used as wealth. When a house worth $100,000 might as well be worth nothing because it cannot secure a loan, cannot be sold beyond your immediate neighborhood, cannot be leveraged to start a business. This is dead capital, and understanding why it exists reveals the hidden architecture that makes Western prosperity possible while leaving billions behind. Your home exists in two forms, a physical structure and a title deed representing ownership. That title transforms shelter into capital, enabling you to borrow against it, sell it to strangers, divide ownership among heirs, or use it as collateral. The physical house remains unchanged, but formal property documentation gives it economic superpowers. Without legal title, that same house loses its power. You built it on land you've occupied for 20 years, and everyone locally knows it's yours. But banks won't lend to you. You cannot sell outside your community. If someone disputes ownership, you have no legal recourse. Your house is worth exactly what it's worth as shelter, nothing more. This is reality for billions worldwide. In developing countries, 85% of urban parcels and half of rural parcels exist outside formal property systems. In Egypt, 92% of urban dwellers live in housing that constitutes dead capital. In Haiti, untitled real estate holdings total $5.2 billion, four times the assets of all legally operating companies in the entire country. Western nations possess something so fundamental they've forgotten it exists, a property system that automatically converts assets into capital. This system performs six extraordinary functions simultaneously. It fixes economic potential in writing. A title deed captures not the house's physical characteristics, but its economic essence, making it tradable and leverageable. It integrates all property information into one unified system rather than hundreds of disconnected arrangements. It makes people accountable by linking them indelibly to their assets. It makes assets fungible, transforming rigid physical things into flexible representations that can be divided, combined, and reconfigured. It creates networks by connecting assets to owners, owners to addresses, and ownership to enforcement. Finally, it protects transactions through continuous tracking and public records. Consider utilities. In Western nations, power companies profitably deliver electricity because formal property systems link buildings to identifiable owners who pay bills. In developing nations, utilities suffer 30 to 50% losses because they cannot reliably identify who owes what. The difference isn't power generation technology, it's the invisible legal infrastructure that makes billing possible. Most Americans don't realize the United States faced identical problems two centuries ago. George Washington complained about banditti illegally occupying lands, skimming the cream of the country. Settlers were technically squatters who invented their own property systems. Tomahawk rights by marking trees, cabin rights by building cabins, and corn rights by raising crops. These extra legal arrangements were bought, sold, and transferred like official titles because official titles were inaccessible and expensive. The breakthrough came through preemption, allowing settlers to purchase land they'd improved before public sale. By 1841, Congress passed prospective legislation covering all future settlers. This wasn't charity, it was pragmatic recognition that formal law must adapt to actual behavior. The American property system succeeded by incorporating existing social contracts rather than fighting them. Switzerland followed the same path when Eugen Huber adapted Roman legal doctrines to local customs. The lesson? Successful property systems aren't imposed from above, but built from below, recognizing and formalizing arrangements people have already created. Yet developing nations today repeat the mistakes America avoided, forcing European legal codes onto populations whose existing property arrangements work locally but cannot connect to the broader economy. When researchers tried to legally register a small garment workshop near Lima, Peru, the process required 289 days of bureaucratic procedures costing $1,231, 31 times the monthly minimum wage. Building a legal house on state-owned land took 207 administrative steps across 52 government offices spanning nearly 7 years. These aren't accidental inefficiencies. They're walls protecting the privileged few inside the bell jar of formal economy from outside competition. Yet those outside aren't idle. Developing nations' informal economies buzz with entrepreneurial energy. Straightside workshops manufacture everything from clothing to machinery. In Mexico City alone, 150,000 vendor stands would stretch 210 kilometers if placed end-to-end. These entrepreneurs fill crucial gaps in the formal economy, often providing better service at lower cost. The problem isn't lack of documentation. Even in Haiti, with 55% illiteracy, researchers never found a single extra-legal plot without at least one document defending the owner's claim. The problem is that these documents exist in hundreds of disconnected systems that cannot communicate with each other or with the formal economy. Reforming property systems is fundamentally a political challenge. Powerful minorities benefit from the status quo. Elites navigate complex bureaucracies easily, face no competition from the talented poor unable to formalize businesses, and profit from informal arrangements that give them leverage over those without legal standing. Opening capitalism to the masses threatens these privileges, which is why reform requires leadership from the very top. Only presidents or prime ministers can overcome bureaucratic inertia and vested interests. However, reform isn't zero sum. Legal integration serves nearly every interest group when properly designed. The poor gain access to credit and expanded markets. Construction companies, banks, and utilities gain millions of new customers. Governments obtain reliable databases for providing services and collecting taxes. The key is demonstrating to elites that lifting the bell jar creates a bigger pie for everyone, not just redistributing existing slices. Capitalism fails outside the West not because globalization doesn't work, but because developing nations haven't globalized capital within their own borders. Billions remain at capitalism's periphery with no real stake in the system. Their trillions in dead capital stay trapped in informal agreements without the common standards needed to function in the marketplace. Consider Bill Gates. Without patents, enforceable contracts, limited liability, property records, stock options, and hereditary succession, his empire would be impossible. The difference between Gates and an equally talented Cairo entrepreneur isn't intelligence, it's access to a system that makes assets productive. We stand at a crossroads. Current reforms benefit only globalized elites while excluding most of humanity. This creates the class confrontation Marx predicted, concentrated capital breeding resentment among the excluded majority. When rising expectations aren't met, seemingly solid elites topple, as in Iran, Venezuela, and Indonesia. The challenge isn't defeating communism. That battle is won. It's making capitalism work for everyone by extending property rights to billions currently locked out. The tools exist. The wealth exists. What's missing is political will. The question isn't whether this transformation is possible. America and Europe proved it is. The question is whether we'll choose to make it happen.